Welcome to the 12th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free number anyone may call for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody followed by the number 8. If you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. What would you have to say if you'd been hit by the worst natural disaster in America's history, driven from your home, and left to face homelessness because the help you've gotten isn't nearly enough? What would you say if you were living somewhere else and talking to someone in the disaster zone? These are easy questions to answer. Just listen in to the Open Mic Hour coming up right after this.
There's one particular building on East Lake where we've got about 76 guys, chronic alcoholics. 10 of them get up every morning and go to work. They may drink themselves into oblivion at night, but they get up the next morning and they go to work.
Although the mayor's support for a program that houses chronic alcoholics is controversial in its own right, what has garnered more press is what the mayor hasn't supported. Since last September, the mayor's been playing political hardball with a homeless encampment called Nicholsville. You may have driven by or seen pictures of the 100 or so pink tents that have come to symbolize the encampment. In a stealth mission, Nicholsville was erected overnight. They chose a large piece of unused public land in an industrial section of West Seattle. The encampment does background checks on all new residents to wean out sexual predators, and residents must follow a list of 17 rules that include no weapons, no aggressive behavior or language, and quiet time must be obeyed. The camp calls itself Nicholsville because of what they feel has been inhumane treatment from the Seattle mayor, especially with his rules regarding homeless encampment sweeps. While the name has generated buzz in the community and the media, it almost certainly has caused the mayor to put on his political boxing gloves.
I mean, clearly the name of it is a politically charged name. It was a political protest, kind of a wildcat thing, so there aren't any health and safety standards, and that is a concern.
And as the tents were filling up, the mayor was sending in police and city workers to clear the site out. After three stands against the mayor and three subsequent moves, Nicholsville now finds itself in what they believe is the protective custody of the church. The pink tents now fill up the parking lot of the University Congregation Church in the University District. For Pastor Catherine Foote, the reasoning behind accepting the embattled homeless group was simple.
We're a church, and what we do is we offer shelter to folks on the edge and on the margins. And when they asked us, we said yes.
The move to the church may temporarily keep Nicholsville out of the reach of the long arm of the mayor, but it hasn't stopped the political mudslinging. The Seattle mayor appeared on TV recently and redefined what he thinks Nicholsville really is.
Well, first of all, let's understand that the folks who were there aren't necessarily homeless. They are homeless advocates.
I mean, are you doubting that most people in the tents are
yes
have another home?
Yes.
And they're just there
make a political point.
I went to Nicholsville to see for myself who lives there. As I entered the encampment, I saw what looked like the Disneyland of refugee camps. Roughly 100 pink tents are packed almost on top of each other in the asphalt parking lot. The camp is encased by chain-link fence, and the only entrance is through a security tent that closely monitors who enters. Heavy rain and winds were blowing tents sideways, and residents rushed to keep them from collapsing altogether. A group warmed themselves around the camp's only fire, while others joked around the barbecue, cooking chicken and burgers. I soon met a former heroin addict named Billy, who was able to kick the drug cold turkey during his first week at Nicholsville. He told me what he thought about the mayor's claims that most residents are really just homeless advocates.
Pardon my French, he's full of s***. If I wasn't homeless, show me the bed that I was supposed to have and I'd be there. Do you think I like sleeping in a tent in 10-degree weather? How can he say something about something that he's never seen? He's never been here. We'd offer him to come out here. He'll never come out here.
Even though the mayor won't come out to see for himself, there are others arriving every day trying to get a rare empty tent in the encampment.
We get 10 or 15 people a day come in needing a place to stay. We only have the capacity for 100 people because the parking lot that we have isn't that big. So we have to turn people away.
Earl came to Nicholsville after being kicked out of the woods. Being homeless on and off for 12 years has taught him why Nicholsville is so important and why the homeless are knocking down the door to get in.
People are dying out on the streets. People are freezing to death. People are getting beaten to death. There's 44 people died this year because they had no place to go, no safe place to sleep, no blankets to put around them. People might be laying in an opening of a business. Somebody come up and want that spot, beat them up for it.
If believers in Nicholsville have their way, the encampment will permanently move to a piece of property large enough for up to 1,000 homeless. This, they say, will finally provide an alternative to sleeping on the streets. But if their plans require the support of Mayor Nichols, some believe the homeless may have better luck taking up the bottle instead of the Nicholsville cause.
From Seattle, that's reporter Adam Vaughn.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Homelessness Marathon. We got all kinds of things going in this hour. Those numbers to call in, and yes, the phones are working, 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. I believe when we left off, we had somebody, Arash, from San Francisco on the line. Is Arash still there? All right, maybe things are not working so well. Okay, we don't have Arash anymore. Oh, no kidding, the phones are out. I'm just being given a note that the phones have gone down again. Hey, phones are down, and I don't even have anybody at the mic at the moment, so I'm just going to have to vamp. But, oh, wait, we do have somebody at the mic. And we will get to that in a moment. Okay, and I'm told that I have guests, but we don't have anybody on the phone because the phones are out. Well, now, just a moment. I'm being told things are happening that we have Steve Thomas on the phone, but how can I have Steve Thomas on the phone if I have no phones? I don't understand what I'm being told, frankly, folks. At the mic, I have John Hosey of the Mississippi Interfaith Disaster Task Force. John, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. I can't hear you either. Are you speaking?
I'm speaking now. There it goes.
Oh, okay. Well,
a little technical difficulties. Clear out all the bugs before the sun comes up.
Well, I tell you, you know, there is... now I'm getting messages, and I sort of understand what's going on. But it's a little confusing. You know, this is live radio, and we're now in our, I think it's our 12th hour.
12th hour.
So things do happen, folks, and there's a reason why people avoid live radio, but live TV and live everything they avoid. But you know what? If you avoid everything that's live, you're kind of avoiding life. So we're glad to be live, but it does sometimes have some problems that go with it. John, tell us what you have seen in your time. How long have you been dealing? Have you been here since Katrina struck? Were you
here actually
before?
I was living in Biloxi, about a half a mile from the beach, and was fortunate enough to live in an area that they call the High Point of the Peninsula in Biloxi, and did not know how significant the damage was till I went to the beach and then started to get out and work and see the need. And as far as you could go from Alabama to Louisiana, it was total destruction.
And you've been working at it ever since?
Ever since. At first, I was working in the construction field, actually. The job that I had folded, so I got my truck, my tools, and went to work. And I have a background in mental health and also as a clergy member. I was a pastor for 16 years.
Uh-huh.
And so I saw a greater need as I got out and started seeing the devastation. I also saw families that were experiencing a lot of trauma as well.
Well, John, I'm going to ask you to hold on for a minute because
sure.
We have a guest on the phone. We cannot take incoming calls, but apparently this is what confused me. We do have a guest on the phone, and I want to talk to him, and maybe you can both talk or something, but hang on. We have Steve Thomas on the line. Is Steve there?
Yes, I'm here, Jamie. How are you this morning?
Well, I'm good. Of course, I always am a little better when the phones are working, but well, that's okay, Steve. And you are in Washington, D.C., is that correct?
Yes, I am.
And you work with an outfit called Streets TV?
Yes.
Can you tell us what that is?
Well, Streets TV, we're an organization that strives to reach, educate, and transform society by making sense of life on the streets. And we do that by empowering the homeless, and we strive to reach, educate, and transform self.
I'm not sure I know what that means, so in practical terms.
Okay, well, we're an organization that works continuously to empower the homeless, giving them a hand up rather than a hand out.
Okay. Now, I know you've done some videos and you've done some very good work. Can you tell us what life is like for homeless people in Washington, D.C.?
Well, you know, this being the nation's capital, it's quite ironic the number of homeless people that in this city. I guess the best way that I could describe life as a homeless person is just it's difficult. Life as a homeless individual anywhere is difficult.
That's right.
No different here in Washington.
Are the police kind to the homeless people in Washington?
I don't know whether you can say they're kind. I would say that for the most part, they're tolerant to some extent.
And why is that? Do you think that's because they know it's an overwhelming problem and there's no point in rousting people when they have nowhere to go?
I don't know whether that's that. I think the advocacy community here raises enough stink to keep them on their toes. During the inauguration that just passed, we had quite a bit of trouble because homeless people were being thrown out of the somewhat widened safety zone around the festivities. So they rousted all the homeless in the area and sent them off to faraway shelters with no transportation back into the city. So what they were trying to do and what they pretty much succeeded in doing is making the homeless invisible.
You know, this happens, and I was in 88, I was writing about the Los Angeles Olympics that happened there. Then I started covering the 92 Olympics in Atlanta. This is before I started the homelessness marathon, and it's just a fact that whenever anything is going on, they try and sweep the homeless out of sight. I'm sorry to hear that happened with Obama's inauguration, especially when most of the homeless in D.C. are African-American.
Correct. And I guess those are some of the issues that we just have to deal with, you know, being the nation's capital.
Let me stay on the phone, Steve, but let me ask John, who's also at the mic. Have they gotten to the point around here in Mississippi where they're trying to get the desperate people out of sight?
Well, you see that in a lot of the cities here on the coast. Biloxi, I think, is one of them, where the homeless issue is kept on the back burner, if not on the burner at all. And the way they do that is to ignore the fact that for the need for shelters. We don't really have a homeless shelter here on the coast, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so they deal with it by pretending that it's not there.
But what about the homeless people who are out there on the streets or the people who are in the... Do they get swept? Is there ever anything here, any reason why they ever get... You don't have the big tourist events down here right now, I guess.
Yeah, I can't speak to every municipality on the coast, but I do know that there is an effort to get them to the back of the city, the places where there might be shelters, if not arrested and put in jail if they can, to get them off the streets, especially in the summertime when we have a lot of tourists here.
Steve, what kinds of services are available for the homeless people in D.C.?
Well, there are limited services. You know, we have the permanent supportive housing program here in D.C. that's being administered right now. Although a month or two ago, the funding was cut due to the economic crisis. What I'm most concerned about are that the services, the job training, and the job placement services in this city aren't really there for the homeless. You know, we feel as though these services should be right in the homeless shelters. In D.C., in the homeless shelters, they have to leave at 7 o'clock in the morning unless it's hypothermia. And then they have all day to do absolutely nothing, and then they're not allowed into sometimes 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes, that's very common around the country. And do you have to? You don't have a guaranteed bed when you come back in, do you?
Well, not in all cases, but if you've been there 2 or 3 consecutive days, then staff usually allows you to have the same bed up until a certain time, a couple of hours after opening. If you haven't showed up within, I think, 3 hours upon shelter opening, then you can possibly lose your bed.
But is it the same there as it is in other places? Like, if you have to go to the emergency room and you wait and you miss the bed check-in or whatever it's called, you can lose your bed for the night. You sometimes might have to choose between, say, health care and getting to bed because it's not guaranteed.
True.
Yeah, all right. Well, hang on, Steve. We got another guest on the line, and I think why not just make a big discussion out of this and people from diverse walks of life. We have Judy from Alabama on the line. Judy, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, thank you for participating in the Homelessness Marathon, Judy. Tell people what's going on in Alabama. Should we assume that because you were a little further away from Hurricane Katrina that you guys are just doing fine down there?
I wasn't further away. I was on the water, and my house blew away.
Okay, so you got... There was some devastation in Alabama, which people maybe don't realize.
They don't realize. That's why we're going to Washington tomorrow. This is our third trip to try to raise awareness and try to raise funds. We have people stealing FEMA trailers. I was lucky enough, because I'm in real estate, to know how to pull strings, and I got into a little house that's further inland. But I lost my home and everything that was in it.
And the people in Alabama that you know who couldn't pull the strings as well as you, where are they now?
They're still in FEMA trailers.
Mm-hmm.
And under bridges. And it's still devastation here. And we can't seem to get any response from our government to try to help the people here. And... like I said, there's three of us going to D.C. Tomorrow.
Are you testifying? What are you doing there?
We're lobbying.
Okay, and so you're okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, and this is our third time, and we've had $17 million allocated to Brewville Homes, and nothing's happened. Nothing's happened.
You feel you've been kind of forgotten there?
Absolutely. You know, I know that the devastation was larger in New Orleans and in Mississippi, but Alabama took a hard hit, and we just hadn't had any response. So,
well, hang on a second, Judy. Steve, do you think the homeless people in Washington, D.C. are in competition with the homeless people in Alabama and with the homeless people in Mississippi? And I mean, is this a competition at this point, do you see, or do you think there's a way there can be solidarity?
I'm sure there's a way there can be solidarity. Even up here in D.C., the population, the homeless community and all, our hearts and our prayers go out to everybody that had to go through Katrina. So, I mean, we understand the immediate need down that way. So I wouldn't say that there's a competition. We totally understand the need for the Katrina victim.
John, at the mic, you want to say?
Yeah, I was just going to say that the Katrina event was so large that a lot of the displaced residents that left this area went to other areas to try to make it work and simply became homeless in another area. Denver, Phoenix, Arizona.
Houston, Atlanta.
Memphis. If you go across the country, you'll find people that are from this area that really felt like they could make it somewhere else. And kind of brings up some of the issues we were talking about tonight with people that can't get IDs, people that don't have a FEMA number. There's all these different issues. People are homeless for a lot of different reasons.
Right.
And there's a lot of different solutions. And I think, you know, it's a matter of us working collaboratively together across different cities and looking for these solutions, seeing what they are.
Steven.
We have a number of people up here in D.C. that suffered from Katrina that's living up here in the shelters also.
And they're in the shelters, and they're not being taken care of any better than anybody else, I take it.
No, not at all. They're going through the same thing as everyone else. They're not getting what I see as any priority treatment.
Well, you know, and I'm not even arguing that they should get priority treatment, because when you're talking about homeless people, they're all deep in the, as First President Bush used to say, they're all in deep doo-doo down there. So what's the difference? They all need help. And Judy, I was told by the people that I talked to at FEMA that FEMA was not operating in Alabama, but you're telling me that it is.
Sort of.
Okay, what does that mean, sort of?
That means they were in here and they helped us somewhat, but they're long gone. All they've left us are these poison trailers.
I
which
see.
Which is true. My husband had 3 strokes and finally died.
No, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, and we lived in a FEMA trailer for a year, and we have friends that died in FEMA trailers.
And do you think this is related to the formaldehyde or just a coincidence?
No, I think it's formaldehyde and stress.
Okay. And basically everybody, I mean, again, we're speaking to the nation now, and people just don't understand. Everybody who went through Katrina, basically, unless they were lucky, they are stressed. They are suffering.
Absolutely. All kind of stress-related medical problems. You know, it's not over. You know, people like to think that, well, that was 3.5 years ago. Get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get over something like that. You know, it changes your life forever. And it's changed lives for people that are living under bridges now or living in these awful trailers. And, you know, I've just been lucky that I got a little house.
Are you able to be in the real estate business again now?
No, I don't. All I do is volunteer.
Okay, and that's by choice, or is that because you can't be in that business now?
It's by choice.
Mm-hmm.
My husband was president of a community group that we formed after Katrina, and I'm trying to carry on.
For him and for the people down there?
For him. For yeah. him and for the people down here. And as I said, that's why we were lucky enough to get involved with a group out of Louisiana that funds us to go to Washington.
Well, that's great. Judy, stay on the line. And Steve, hang on. John, we have another person waiting to speak at the mic, so I'd like to just kind of wrap up with you. I'm glad
okay.
we have people at the mic, but Judy, stay on the line. And I'm glad we have people waiting to be on the mic because we can't take in any calls right now. What would you say, John, if you're, well, you are talking to America, what would be the number one thing you'd want America to understand right now that from your perspective of what you're seeing?
I think that to sum it up is that it takes a long time to rebuild total devastation. And if you were looking back to the World War II era and mm-hmm. Europe and devastation that was in Europe, it didn't happen in 3.5 years. Rebuilding took decades. And I think that, you know, the government first come here, they said it's going to take 8 years to recover. Now it's 3.5 years, and they're telling us to get over it, you know, or it should be completed. And I think that everybody here would like to have it out of the way. They would like to have it as a something they can put it behind them. But we're seeing increase in mental health issues. Post-traumatic stress is on the rise, and domestic violence and all these other issues. So Katrina is still a real part of life here. It's still a part that people can't understand unless they experienced it.
Suicide is on the rise.
Suicide, we're told, is on the rise. There's new statistics coming out all the time that are telling us. And we have a shortage here of mental health professionals, and it's difficult for them to move here when housing is not affordable, housing is not readily available to them. So there's still a lot of issues here, a lot of things to do, a lot of work to be done. And I think that, you know, the country as a whole is suffering right now with the economy. But I think it's important for people to remember that lives were devastated and ruined here. A lot of lives were lost here, and the recovery is going to go on for years to come. And I think as Americans, we can pull together and see what we can do to help each other.
Okay, well, thank you very much, John. And I very much appreciate the help you've given us with this broadcast, and thank you for coming to the mic. I'm getting the suspicion that maybe our phones are back in order because I'm told that Arash is back on the phone. Arash, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. What would you like to say? Welcome back.
Yeah, I just want to touch on a couple issues. Mostly what's going on overseas. We're spending, you know, $750 billion in, Iraq and Afghanistan on military expenditures. And, we can't even deal with, our own domestic problems. Like, a lot of people are talking about Katrina. It's still in ruins. And, the federal government isn't even, taking a priority to domestic issues. And another thing is we have to ask, why are these people homeless? It's not just because, the lack of jobs. It's also, and during Reagan's administration, he deinstitutionalized a lot of public mental health facilities, which put a lot of people that aren't even capable of working out on the streets. And that's just another thing. And another thing I see in San Francisco is there's a huge drug problem. I mean, especially in the lower income areas, like the Tenderloin area, crack cocaine and heroin are just, it's all over the place.
But, Arash, I think these are kind of more myths about homelessness, really. The deinstitutionalization.
Oh, no, it's not a myth. I see these people every single day. I talk with people.
Yes, I understand that, Arash, but look. It was Kennedy who signed the Community Mental Health Act, and that was in 63. The homelessness crisis didn't start until the early 80s, so it isn't really deinstitutionalization. And we had waves of drug use. We had heroin. We had all kinds of things before we had the crack epidemic, and those things did not result in homelessness. It's true that we've got people who are mentally ill. We've got people who are using drugs, but homelessness really comes from something else, I think.
What do you think is the main attributing factor to homelessness in the U.S. right now?
Well, I think it's a combination of things, but it's number one is poverty, the reduction in the value of the minimum wage, the fact that we stopped building houses. And in the 1970s, we had something like 5 million surplus low-income housing units, and today we probably have that much of a deficit. There just isn't the housing, and the minimum wage won't get you into housing. And that's the real change that has occurred. There's many other factors, but I'd say that's the biggest one.
If I'm ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I work with the National Coalition for the Homeless.
Well, I'm not going to hold that against you.
And according to their studies, nationally, the five leading causes of homelessness, one being lack of affordable housing,
right,
being lack of health care, three, domestic violence, four, poor-paying jobs, and five, mental illness. Drug and alcohol abuse is not even in the top five.
Right. Well,
but in the Washington metropolitan area, drug and alcohol addiction and abuse is the number one cause of homelessness here in Washington.
I really have to dispute that because, look, we had Robert Downey Jr., who was such a drug addict, he got sent to prison, and for goodness sake, the guy had millions of dollars in... He himself was quoted as saying, I've just always got to stick the gun in my mouth. He couldn't control himself. He was never homeless. We had Daryl Strawberry, who was a wealthy sports guy who was all kinds of trouble he was in, but he wasn't homeless. If you're rich and you're a drug addict, you don't become homeless. If you're rich and you're mentally ill, you don't become homeless. It's not about those things. It's about poverty.
But the vast majority of the... Of the American people are not rich.
This is true, but the thing is, again, I come back to this analogy. Both spiders and flies will get into your tub, but the flies don't get caught in it. What really happens is that a lot of people fall into homelessness, but if you're addicted or if you're mentally challenged, it's harder to get out. But that's not the same as saying that it's a cause. Plenty of people are mentally ill. A lot of them, I think, are running our government, who are not homeless. That's the reality.
Okay, well, I'm speaking from the standpoint that I was addicted to drugs and alcohol for over 40 years.
Okay.
And alcohol were the number one contributing factor to me becoming homeless in the streets in Washington, D.C.
All right. Well, I want to come back to this point, but right now I want to thank Judy very much. Judy, you have a last thing to say because we need your phone line, actually.
Actually, you can have my phone line. I just wanted to say I have a son that's homeless, and I haven't been in touch with him for a year. He doesn't even know that my husband died. And is there any resource to locate these people?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
But if I ever find out about one, we'll get in touch. And
I'd appreciate that.
I wish you all the best, Judy, and thank you very much for participating. At the microphone, we have Thomas. Thomas, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you, Jeremy. How are you doing this morning?
I'm still alive. That's a good sign, I think. What would you like us to know?
Jeremy, I was also an evacuee for Katrina when all this went about. We waited and waited. We got a FEMA trailer. We went through that process. I was not a landowner at the time. I was renting. So after the storm, we were able to get a MEMA cottage. I also got involved in purchasing a piece of land. And the Gustav came up. And, you know, we was doing fine. My wife is the only one working right now because I'm in school. I'm trying to get my GED. But my wife was the only one working, and we was doing fine. You know, we wasn't making all that great bit of money, but we were paying our bills, and things was getting done, and we was moving up. Well, like I said, Gustav came along, and we didn't get a whole bunch of water. I guess about 5-6 foot. It took about 4 inches at a MEMA cottage. After that, we come back to check on our belongings. And we had just about everything. There was a lot of things that had went underwater. We was using outside storage on a house we had bought, and we was throwing a lot of things underneath there. But, we were finally able to get out of there and get into a hotel room that MEMA was helping us with. We went in after the storm. We got out of there, and we went into a hotel room for... I guess 2-3 weeks. FEMA has paid for a few of them nights, but there are other nights that they didn't pay for. We spent a lot of money on hotel rooms, storage, among other things, and yet to be reimbursed for that. But
hang on a second, because I got a lot of things going on here. Okay. Arash, are you still on the line? No, Arash. Okay. All right. Well, let's go on a little further with your story, and then we got another call lined up. Those numbers, by the way, if the phones are working, are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Go ahead, Thomas. Tell us more of your story.
But like I said, Gustav came along. We had some damage. It wasn't all that bad. We did stay in it. After a while, we couldn't afford the hotel room, so we moved on. We had to go back to the cottage, and there was a notice on the door telling us we couldn't return without our caseworker or some kind of MEMA personnel that could let us back in our cottage. So that was fine. We left again. We went, tried to find a place. We went and stayed with a local friend of ours. Finally, we had to go back to the cottage. And by this time, there was a smell of mold, mildew. Among other things, the carpet in the bedroom was still soaking wet. It was miserable. We stayed in there approximately a month. And finally, the MEMA caseworker would come by and you know, we'd show her that, you know, it's not what he wanted to be among the mold and the mildew. And, you know, you're breathing this stuff. And so finally, you know, they smelled that. They, you know, it was there. It was growing on the walls. And they said it was just unhabitable, that we had to go. We couldn't stay there any longer. So they put us in a hotel room. We sat in a hotel room for approximately 3 months. We went through Thanksgiving there. We went through Christmas there. Finally, we got the word here, I guess about a month ago, that we were eligible for rentals assistance. It was a $1,444 rentals assistance that we would qualify to help us, you know, find a home. So we did. We took advantage of that, and we applied for it or whatever we had to do. Finally, we reached it. MEMA caught word of it and told us that we had to leave. We had, it was approximately 7 hours that we had to get out of there. This was the last night that they weren't paying for any longer. So we got up the next morning and we had went out and tried to find us any available apartment that was, you know, that was there that we could get into. So we did. We had took it, you know, we cashed a check and we went on, we put it up, and we paid our first month and our deposit, light deposit, really any deposit we needed to get into the apartment. Well, come to find out here recently, they told us that they weren't going to pay for February, the month of February, that the money they have given us was for rent. It was for January and February. It was not for a deposit of any sort. That
but you couldn't get in without a deposit.
Correct. You know, I mean, I didn't have the extra $500. Now, I'm paying, well, I'm not, but the apartment is $700 a month.
Well, you know, my wife has a saying, help is only help if it helps. And your help hadn't really helped.
No, sir, not at all. I mean, it's got me out of the sleeping bag, but, you know, now I got subpoenaed from the court to appear for court Thursday because we haven't paid the this month. You know, that's one reason we got with FEMA is because we couldn't afford to pay the amount that the local home places are asking for.
Okay. Hang on, Thomas. We'll come back to you. We'll come back to you, Steve. We got Vicki from the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance on the line. Vicki, welcome.
Hello.
Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What would you like us to know? You're in Mississippi. Are there special issues about immigrants vis-a-vis poverty and vis-a-vis Katrina here in Mississippi?
Well, you know, right before Katrina, we had a large population of immigrant communities, both Latino, others, and Asian or Vietnamese communities. And first of all, when Katrina was to hit, there was no notice on radio or television that was in Spanish or any other language other than English. So people were not aware of what was happening. So these communities were not able to evacuate for the most part. As a matter of fact, the place that you're broadcasting from, 601 Josephine Street,
right,
was the place that was probably about 70% or 80% Latino immigrants that were brought in to work at the Gulf Coast Priestress in Pasquistienne. They occupied most of those apartments there.
I didn't know that. The Signature Lake apartments were largely Hispanic.
The Signature Lake apartments, yes, they were. African-American and Hispanic, some white people, mostly very poor people. Hard working class people. And so after Katrina, well, when Katrina hit, the people in those apartments, a lot of them almost died. There was a young man, Eduardo, they called him Lado, who had two little girls, and one of the little girls almost drowned. Someone had to go rescue her because those apartments were literally lifted off of the foundations and running around Pasquistienne or floating around Pasquistienne. And then those people were brought over to the SP shelter, which is about 3-4 miles from where you're at. The borderline from Pasquistienne and Long Beach, and they were evicted from the shelter, presuming that all of the people that were there, which was about 100, 120 immigrants, they were lined up. It was a very humiliating situation. They were actually lined up, and then they were processed, and as they were processed, they would be asking them for documents. And when I say they, it was about 20 officers, including the U.S. Marshals and other states, surrounding states that came to help. And they lined them up outside of the shelter, and as they were processing them, asking them for documents, which everybody lost in the storm, we know that. Whether they were documented or not, we really don't know because everyone lost their
documents. So, in other words, everybody was undocumented after the storm.
Exactly.
Had nothing
exactly
to do. You could have been born here. You were undocumented,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And were they
exactly
asking white people for their documents?
No, they only lined up the Latino-looking population.
Thomas, at the mic, you're saying they didn't ask you for your documents, right? And plenty of people
absolutely
lost them,
not
right?
Yes, sir, correct.
Right.
I lost all the paperwork I had. I had to reapply for birth certificates for Section
right
8.
And we've heard
everything
this before, but nobody lined you up and said, where are your documents, right, because you're not Hispanic?
No, sir.
Okay.
And so they were lined up, and as they were processing them, they would put a black X on the back of their hands. Now, does that sound like a concentration camp? It sounds to me like it is.
Well, not really, no. I must say it does not sound like a concentration camp to me because that's a hell of a lot worse. But never mind.
You know,
it doesn't sound good.
No, but at any rate, the picture that I'm trying to bring here is that they were lined up. They were humiliated. They were told in 3 days they had to leave the shelter. Now, these are all victims of Katrina, that they would have to leave the shelter or in 3 days they would bring buses to deport them all back to Mexico, assuming they were all from Mexico, assuming they were all undocumented, which everyone was after the storm. And that's what they did at that one particular red shelter. And we had that happening at every shelter. We had it happening at the D'Iberville shelter a week after that, the one on DeBees after that. And then they evicted homeless people from a shelter in Biloxi because they didn't have a home to begin with. Therefore, they didn't qualify to be in a shelter. So, I mean, there was all kinds of really ugly things happening down here.
It sounds so really terrible. I have not heard these stories before. I want to go back to Steve for a minute, but hang on, Vicki. Steve, what's going on with Hispanic people in Washington, D.C.? You have an Hispanic population there. Are they also likely to be homeless in Washington, D.C.?
Well, we do have our share of Hispanics that are homeless, and their situation, I wouldn't say is any better or any worse than anybody else's.
So you're not seeing, they're not going into the shelters and looking for undocumented Hispanic people in Washington that you know?
No, not that I know of, no.
Okay. Well, Steve, we've got to free up a phone line, so I want to thank you very much for sharing with us and for being part of the Homelessness Marathon.
And thank you for having me. You all have a blessed day.
You too. Our pleasure. Vicki, let's get back to this. There's another issue about Hispanics here, and I know there's a lot, but is it true, and you would know, that the casinos and others were bringing in deliberately for rebuilding effort Hispanic workers to get cheaper labor and exploiting them here as part of the rebuilding effort? Have you heard about this? Is this something that is true or false, or is that a rumor? What is that?
No, it's not a rumor, and it was actually instituted by our government, so it wasn't something that random. 9 days after Katrina hit, President Bush came on TV, on national TV, and said that he was going to suspend what they call the Davis-Bacon Act, which is a law that was on the books since 1931, and a lot of people don't know this. Since 1931, it actually protects all workers doing any kind of construction, cleanup, or reconstruction under federal contract, and as you know, the five big companies were awarded all of the contracts for the cleanup of the coast, which are Halliburton, Kellogg Brown and Root, and several others. They were the big five that got all of the contracts through or from FEMA. And so, and the other thing that happened is that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, got on the television shortly after that announcement and said that employers would not be bound for 45 days post-Katrina by filling an I-9 form, which is the verification of work eligibility for ICE for immigration purposes. So therefore, it gave open range, open carte blanche to all of the employers, contractors, et cetera, to bring in immigrants, whether they were documented or not. And they were being brought from all over the U.S., and they were also being brought from as far south as Chiapas, Mexico, to do all of this work.
No, I'm told we have incoming phone lines, so let me give out those phone numbers again. 877-NOBODY-8, 877-NOBODY-8, or 866-LEFT-OUT. That's 866-LEFT-OUT. Thomas at the microphone, what is your line of work when you're working?
I'm an air conditioner tech. I worked for a local company in Waveland Bay, St. Louis, for approximately 5 years. I had worked for them the first time for about 3 years and left, and the work got slow. I went back and worked for them approximately 2 years. At the time of Katrina, I was working with another air conditioner company, which is run by my brother-in-law. So I've been in air conditioner work for probably close to 6 years.
And after Katrina, that work disappeared?
Yes, sir. I had to turn to all other alternatives because the small air conditioner company I had worked for in the beginning, he was just small time trying to make a living. You know,
well, who's got an air conditioner if they don't have a house? I think that's kind of obvious, right?
Well, Mr. Jeremy, I tell you what, that you know, everywhere we went, and I was in a fire department just after Katrina, and I have prior fire experience, but you've seen it everywhere. You've seen air conditioners hanging. You've seen air conditioners on the ground. You've seen the compressors just everywhere you look. And, you know, you don't want to release that kind of stuff into the atmosphere. So a lot of people went around picking up that, you know, picking up trash that, you know, was affiliated with that. And work's not, you know, not a problem. You know, it's just, you know, people can't afford to put air conditioners in their new home. I mean, you know, they do cost, a little bit of chunk of money. And a lot of people still can't afford to do that. And
is the work that's available now at a lower-paying wage than what you were getting before?
I don't think it's lower. I think it could be a little bit higher. there's a lot of stuff going on to where, you know, the people do need to make more money to compensate what's going on. You know, gas is, it went up high, it dropped, it's back up, you know, and you just can't afford to function these days here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Nancy from Alabama on the line. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, Nancy, I believe I met you when I was in Alabama. Is that correct?
I think so.
Okay, well, if we both think so, it probably happened then. And tell us, are you here to contradict our previous caller from Alabama and tell us that everything is just fine in Alabama?
No, everything is not fine in this part of Alabama.
Okay.
Not right on the Gulf Coast, it's not.
And why not?
Everyone is not back in the houses from Katrina.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I was visiting with your group down in Alabama, people were telling me that they feel that there's kind of a social engineering going on down there, that they're trying to bring in condos and get rid of the small people there, so to speak, the shrimpers and the small businesses, and make it just for wealthy people on the coast. Is that still your perception down there?
That was the perception I got.
And how do you see this manifesting? I mean, what would give somebody that idea?
Well, money and help being so slow coming into the area.
Uh-huh. So you think they're not really trying to keep you there? They're not giving you the support that you need?
No, we're not getting the support. It's very slow.
Okay. Those numbers, by the way, to call in here are 877-NOBODY-8 or 866-LEFT-OUT. Well, are you trying? Are you lobbying? What are you doing to get the help down there?
We have lobbied. We have a house that's going to soon be restored or built on the street that I live on. And this is going on 4 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still, there's quite a few vacant houses that on the street that I live on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just slow.
When I visited with your group, it was an interracial group, and people seemed to be very close in that group. Do you think, now, this is a discussion that is ongoing, how much of this do you think has to do with race, and how much of it has to do with class and with questions of wealth?
Well, I would say both, you know, the wealth, you know, and the class.
Mm-hmm. But you don't think it's just a race issue down there now at this point?
No, it's class.
It is. Okay.
Yeah, it's both.
Mm-hmm. All right. And what else would you like us to know about what's going on in Alabama?
Well, the thing, if we could get the help here, you know, and people would move back home. It's people are still away. And if able to, it's hard to get out there and start a house from the ground up, you know, by yourself if you 65 years old or older. And it's just hard, especially with jobs, it's hard to find. Mm-hmm. And seafood is the livelihood of so many people in this area. And when that's not happening, then you've got a problem.
Now, you have a problem down there, as I understand it, that the very architecture of the seafood, the landscape has changed so that there's water coming in there that didn't used to come in because of breaks in the barrier reef or something. I'm not exactly sure.
Exactly.
So that the fishing industry is being hurt, and there's not really any help for that.
Yeah, that's it. They're hurting.
Mm-hmm.
The crabbers, oysters. Oystermen out there, and it's just a slow process with so much salt water
coming in.
That's coming in.
I see. And there's no like environmental officials who are helping you or anything like that?
Well, environmental people have been on the job working, you know, and trying to, you know, get help. So they've been, you know, been doing their job.
but it's just slow. That's the bottom
line. It's slow. It's very slow.
All right. Well, Nancy, I want to thank you very much for sharing with us here on the Marathon. And, of course, we wish you folks down in Alabama all the best in your recovery. And we hope we've helped to shed some light on it. And we thank you very much.
You have, and I appreciated that very much.
Great. Good talking to you. Vicki, if you're still there, I'd like to get back to you.
I am.
Where we left off with your story, on the one hand, they're just going to get rid of every Hispanic person claiming that they're undocumented, even if all they really did was lose their paperwork in the flood. And at the same time, they're lifting up the all regulations so they can bring in more Hispanic workers who will work for cheap. Vicki, there's a piece of that that just doesn't make sense to me. Can you help me to understand why that would happen? If you wanted to bring in Hispanic people, why not just take the ones that were already here?
Because most of the ones that are already here are already owed a lot of money. What people don't see and understand is we were able to recover over $1.5 million, and I gave Abby a sheet that depicts all of the different companies and ways and means that we were able to recover that money, and it was by direct action and shaming people into doing the right thing. By
Abby is our
the
producer.
Workers.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. And so it continues to happen. And so a lot of people have been working here on the coast in Mississippi. I'm sure that it's happening in New Orleans, and it might be happening in Alabama. But I know it's been happening here in Mississippi, where they work a week, 2 weeks, they get paid, and then they don't get paid for the next 2 or 3 weeks. And then they get kicked out and say, you know, if you don't leave, we're going to call immigration. And they end up owing these workers 15s and 20s and thousands of dollars. And so virtually we're rebuilding our coast with free immigrant labor, regardless of whether they're documented or not, they're human beings. And we sometimes seem to forget that. And what's happening, when you said that if companies were bringing them in, not only were they coming in as undocumented workers, but we have the shipyard industries, we have the hospitality industry, we have the fishing industries, we have the different industries throughout the state of Mississippi, which these companies claim they didn't have local workers. So they were bringing in H-2B visa holders, J-1 visa holders, and telling them that they were going to be in a nice place to be able to live. And anybody who went through Katrina knows that there's nothing down here to live in.
Right.
So when they were brought in, then they were left on the street. So we had another crisis to contend with, which was a whole bunch of homeless Latino immigrants that didn't know, you know, didn't speak the language and didn't know where to turn. A lot of them were perceived to have no rights, so people weren't helping agencies and so on and so forth. And that's the kind of thing that's been happening. So to have all of these people that are already owed money and rehire them, doesn't make sense. So it makes more sense to bring fresh meat, so to speak, people that don't know what happened going on, and reuse them. And, you know, Haley Barbour, our governor, there was over $64 billion that was given by federal government to rebuild affordable housing and to rebuild the coast. And the only thing that's coming up on the coast is new casinos, condominiums, which nobody can afford, nobody that makes the regular minimum wage or a little bit above minimum can afford them, $500,000, who can afford that? And then the apartments that are supposed to have been rebuilt, that they were supposed to have been affordable apartments, probably most of them are at 80%, unoccupied because the rents are so high and the salaries are so low. Mississippi does not have a state Department of Labor, so we have to go by the federal standard, which is $6.35 an hour. And then on top of that, out of that grant that was supposed to be given to all of the people who have lost their homes, like in East Biloxi, we have Vietnamese communities and African-American communities that are living on fixed incomes or very small amounts or small businesses, and these people don't have the resources to rebuild. Their insurances didn't cover it. They've been waiting for grant money to try to rebuild. None of that money has really trickled down, very little of it. And he went ahead and took $600 million of that and put it into the port of Gulfport to rebuild it, when before the storm it was only going to cost $100 million, and now it's $600 million. So tell me, I don't know what makes sense anymore.
All right, well, that's fair enough. Thomas, do you find yourself competing with workers who are being brought in for cheap labor and exploitable labor here?
At one time, yes, sir, Jeremy, I did. Right now, at this point in time, I'm not even focused on trying to find a job, because right now I'm focused on school. I'm trying to better myself so I can get a better paying job. Right now, at just before Katrina, when I was working for our air conditioner company, it still really wasn't enough to pay the bills. And granted, I don't have a whole lot of bills. I got a few things, you know, but it's not. It's not like a lot of people have. I mean, I'm not stacked up with bills at all. But as for the immigrants coming here right after the storm, I'd like to make a comment on that if I could. There were a lot of them around. They were doing a good job. But the problem comes with that is they work for such a low price that, I mean, I'm not really even sure what I was making at the time. But, you know, I go to every, you know, all these jobs to put these air conditioners in, and that's what you see. You know, these people here, my brother-in-law is out of work right now because, you know, he's in a construction business. He's out of work now because, you know, there's just nothing available. You know, no there's no work going
despite
on.
Despite the need.
Correct.
We got Cricket on the line. Cricket from Bay St. Louis, you there?
I had a comment or a question about the money. Because if you take the amount of money, and I don't know the total amount that was thrown at this disaster, okay, from contributions to federal money, but if you take the number of people here and divide them by the amount of money, I wonder how much money, if the money had been dispersed right as it was meant to be, you know, I would think that the amount of money actually probably could have gotten everybody back into a normal living situation had they got the money.
Well, you may be right. Thank you for the call, Cricket. Vicki, do you have any idea about that? If you divided all the money up by the number of people who were affected, where would we have been?
Well, you know, I don't know that that would be the actual solution. I know that what we were spending on the war in Iran daily would have probably rebuilt the coast of Mississippi.
Yeah, actually, it's the war in Iraq. We aren't doing the war in Iran yet, but give it a few weeks and who knows, you know.
I mean, I would say that the money that they used on a daily basis, any one of those days, could have been used to rebuild the coast. And instead of bringing, and you know, people to work and then not paying them and so on and so forth. Back to the caller that said, you know, competing for low wages with immigrants, I agree with him. But, you know, what we got to look at is that it's not the immigrant. Immigrants don't sit around in their household in their prospective countries thinking, you know, I'm going to go to the United States, leave my country, leave everything that I know to be mine and my language and my religion and my customs and my family. And then I'm going to, you know, cross the borders and I'm going to risk my life several times. And then I'm going to go over there to the U.S. and tell the bosses that I'm going to take away the jobs of those people that are working there. And then on top of that, I'm going to tell them, you know, you got to pay me less money than you pay the American workers.
I don't think we're blaming the immigrants for that. I mean, there are immigrant issues, but that's not what's going on here in Mississippi. That's
I know.
For sure.
What I'm saying is that it's the corporations. It's the greedy corporations that do that because they want more money in their pocket. They want more bottom line. And it's all about that.
By the way, Vicki, are there now instructions about how to get aid and so forth that are printed in Spanish?
There are, but they're very limited to the people who need them. I mean, we've got immigrants that were dumped here by all of these construction companies and contractors who are living 15, 20 people into in a trailer because they cannot afford to move out or live on, you know, on their own. So there are instructions printed in Spanish, but most Latinos don't have access to them. Even the ones that had legal access to obtain FEMA money, when that was happening, the DCRs or the distribution centers for FEMA, they had ICE agents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, guarding the doors of these centers. So even if you had people that were legally present, people are very, very fearful of Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Okay, we're about out of time, Vicki. Does your organization have a website?
We sure do. It's your it's yourmira.org. yourmira.org.
Thank you very much, Vicki, for participating in the homelessness marathon. Thomas, we're just down to our last seconds here, but we want to wish you the very, very best in your schooling and in getting on your feet. Do you think you got a chance?
Yes, sir, Jeremy. It's just going to take time. You know, everybody got wounds to heal, and it's going to take time to put things back together. That's what I'm looking forward to, and hopefully further down the road, the good Lord's got something special for me to get me through this because we're looking at some devastating times ahead of us, especially with the economy going on the way it is.
Well, you've all been devastated down here, and we wish you all the best. And on that note, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back after a few minutes to the Homelessness Marathon.
You are listening to the Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with Community Radio WQRZ of Waveland, Mississippi. The opinions expressed in this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating and affiliated radio stations. To order CDs of this broadcast or to contact the Homelessness Marathon, go to homelessnessmarathon.org.